two solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter.
In these few lines, Hamlet reveals an important aspect of his character to us. He is not a man of action. He would rather flee from conflict than fight. Hamlet is so uncomfortable and unhappy in himself that he wishes his body would just melt away into nothing. Instead of acting on his feelings towards Claudius, he would rather take his own life, but of course cannot, because God the Everlasting says suicide is a mortal sin. Now, I should point out that there has been much debate over the years as to whether Hamlet's flesh is solid, S-O-L-I-D, sullied, S-U-L-L-I-E-D, or sallied, S-A-L-L-I-E-D. The earliest texts say sallied, which means to be attacked or besieged. Later texts say solid, which contrasts well with melt and dew and makes for better poetry, yet it lacks the intensity of sullied, a popular choice with modern editors. Sullied, which means dirty and squalid, gives the sense that talking to Claudius makes Hamlet's skin crawl, that he feels contaminated by him. Now, the use of solid here also poses the interesting question of whether Hamlet was fat. Hamlet is generally seen as a young man with deep philosophical issues around violence and an emotional distance between himself and his family. But what if a part of that is body image? I can't be a king because I'm too fat and clumsy. Now, there are a few references in the play to Hamlet being physically slow, solid, and less dexterous than he would like. And in the year 2000, the Royal National Theatre cast Simon Russell Beale, who is a bear of a man. In fact, Stephen Wickham, who plays Polonius in our production, played the part of Hamlet in a version subtitled The Tragedy of a Fat Man. Of course, there's no evidence to suggest that the first Hamlet, Richard Burbage, was bulky, but it does show that Shakespeare is able to weave in references that allow for a myriad of interpretations.
Oh, God! Oh, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world. Fie on, fie, 'tis an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely. That it should come to this.
Hamlet sees no order in nature, but a world that is dangerous, sick, and offers him nothing. Like an overgrown garden, its weeds spread and sprawl into everything like a cancer.
But 2 months dead, nay, not so much, not two. So excellent a king that was to this Hyperion to a satyr.
Hamlet compares his father, who we are told died 2 months ago, to Hyperion, the Greek god of the sun, and his uncle to a lowly satyr, a mythical creature, half man, half goat. For the Globe's audience, goats were considered to be lecherous beasts, and satyrs associated with strong drink and sex mania.
So loving to my mother, that he might not beteem the winds of heaven visit her face too roughly. Heaven and earth must I remember. Why, she would hang on him, as if increase of appetite had grown by what it fed on, and yet, within a month, let me not think on't, frailty, thy name is woman. A little month, or ere those shoes were old, with which she followed my poor father's body, like Niobe, all tears. Why, she, oh God, a beast that wants discourse of reason would have mourned longer, married with my uncle, my father's brother, but no more like my father than I to Hercules. Within a month, yet the salt of most unrighteous tears had left a flashing in her galled eyes. She married. Almost wicked speed, to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets. It is not, nor it cannot come to good. But break my heart, for I must hold my tongue.
Hamlet has no understanding or empathy for his mother whatsoever. Her actions simply confirm his belief that all women are weak and will do whatever they are told. One minute she's weeping like Niobe, a character from Greek legend who cried so much for her dead children that she was transformed into a statue to weep forever. Then, with most wicked speed, within a month her tears are dry and she's marrying her dead husband's brother, which, according to the Bible, Leviticus chapter 18 verse 16, is both incestuous and illegal. Hamlet clearly has an idealized view of his father, and in contrast, a very poor image of himself. Keeping silent about his uncle and his mother is breaking his heart, but he feels powerless to do anything about it. In his eyes, Claudius could never compare to his father, and he can never compare to Hercules. He's not cut out to be a hero. Now Horatio enters with Marcellus and Bernardo.
Hail to your lordship.
I am glad to see you well. Horatio! Or I do forget myself!
The same, my lord, and your poor servant ever.
Sir, my good friend, I'll change that name with you. And what make you from Wittenberg, Horatio? Marcellus.
My good lord.
I am very glad to see you. Good even, sir. But what in faith make you from Wittenberg?
A truant disposition, good my lord.
I would not hear your enemy say so, nor shall you do my ear that violence to make it truster of your own report against yourself. I know you are no truant. But what is your affair in Elsinore? We'll teach you to drink deep ere you depart.
My lord, I came to see your father's funeral.
I prithee do not mock me, fellow student. I think it was to see my mother's wedding.
Indeed, my lord, it followed hard upon...
Hamlet is genuinely pleased to see Horatio. Until this point, he has been self-absorbed and alone in his grief, but now has a friend, an intellectual equal to turn to. Their Wittenberg connection also serves as a reminder of his own reason and intelligence, and that he is in control of his life.
Thrift. Thrift, Horatio. The funeral baked meats did coldly furnish forth the marriage tables.
And here we see his black sense of humour. The funeral and wedding were so close that the meat cooked hot for one was served cold for the other.
Would I had met my dearest foe in heaven or ever I had seen that day, Horatio. My father. Methinks I see my father.
Where, my lord?
In my mind's eye, Horatio.
I saw him once. He was a goodly king.
He was a man. Take him for all in all, I shall not look upon his like again.
My lord, I think I saw him yesternight.
Saw who?
My lord, the king, your father.
The king, my father.
Season your admiration for a while with an attent ear, till I may deliver, upon the witness of these gentlemen, this marvel to you.
For God's love, let me hear.
2 nights together had these gentlemen, Marcellus and Bernardo, on their watch in the dead waste and middle of the night, been thus encountered. A figure, like your father, armed at point exactly cap-a-pie.
That means head to toe. So old Hamlet appeared to them in full armour, ready to do battle.
Appears before them, and with solemn march goes slow and stately by them. Thrice he walked by their oppressed and fear-surprised eyes, within his truncheon's length, whilst they... distilled almost to jelly with the act of fear, stand dumb and speak not to him. This to me, in dreadful secrecy, in part they did, and I with them the third night kept the watch, where, as they had delivered both in time, form of the thing, each word made true and good, the apparition comes. I knew your father. These hands are not more like.
But where was this?
My lord, upon the platform where we watch.
Did you not speak to it?
My lord, I did, but answer made it none. Yet once methought it lifted up its head and did address itself to motion, like as it would speak. But even then the morning cock crew loud, and at the sound it shrunk in haste away and vanished from our sight.
'Tis very strange.
As I do live, my honoured lord, 'tis true. And we did think it writ down in our duty to let you know of it.
Indeed, sirs, but this troubles me. Hold you the watch tonight.
We do, my lord. My lord.
Armed, say you?
Armed, my lord.
From top to toe?
My lord.
Lord, from head to foot.
Then saw you not his face?
Oh, yes, my lord, he wore his beaver up.
The beaver part of the helmet face was open to show the ghost's expression.
What looked he frowningly?
A countenance more in sorrow than in anger.
Pale or red?
Nay, very pale.
And fixed his eyes upon you?
Most constantly.
I would I had been there.
It would have much amazed you.
Very like. Stayed it long?
While one with moderate haste might tell 100.
So the ghost stayed only for the time it takes to count to 100.
Longer.
Longer.
Oh, not when I saw it.
His beard was grizzled, no?
It was as I've seen it in his life, a sable silvered.
I will watch tonight. Perchance to walk again.
I warrant it will.
If it assume my noble father's person, I'll speak to it, though hell itself should gape and bid me hold my peace. I pray you all, if you have hitherto concealed this sight, let it be tenable in your silence still. And whatsoever else shall hap tonight, give it an understanding, but no tongue. I will requite your loves, so fare you well. Upon the platform twixt 11 and 12, I'll visit you.
Our duty to your honour.
Your loves as mine to you. Farewell.
Having made plans to meet between 11 and midnight that evening, Horatio, Marcellus and Bernardo leave. Hamlet is alone.
My father's spirit. In arms. All is not well.
His father's ghost in full armour has well and truly aroused Hamlet's suspicions. All is not well. For the first time, he questions whether his father died of natural causes and says that crimes or foul play must eventually come to light, even if the whole world conspires to bury them. Now, this is very interesting because Hamlet believes in the existence of some force or agency that will not let evil go uncovered. He is a man of great moral authority and believes in order and retribution.
I doubt some foul play. Would the night were come. Till then, sit still, my soul. Foul deeds will rise, though all the earth overwhelm them to men's eyes.
The scene ends as Hamlet hurries off. He can hardly wait for the evening to come around so that he can learn the truth. Act 1, Scene 3. We are at the house of Polonius, the king's chief courtier. His son and daughter, Laertes and Ophelia, enter together. Remember, in the last scene, Laertes was given permission to leave Denmark and return to France. But before he goes, he has some words of advice for his sister.
My necessaries are embarked. Farewell. And, sister, as the winds give benefit and convoy's assistant, do not sleep, but let me hear from you.
Do you doubt that?
For Hamlet and the trifling of his favour, hold it a fashion and a toy in blood, a violet in the youth of primy nature, forward, not permanent, sweet, not lasting, the perfume and suppliance of a minute, no more.
Laertes warns that while Hamlet makes a show of his feelings now, they won't last, and so Ophelia should try and not take him too seriously.
No more but so.
Think it no more. For nature crescent does not grow alone in thews and bulks, but as this temple waxes, the inward service of the mind and soul grows wide with awe. Perhaps he loves you now. And now no soil nor cortal doth besmirch the virtue of his will, but you must fear. His greatness weighed, his will is not his own. For he himself is subject to his birth.
Laertes is quite the realist here. At the end of the day, Hamlet is a prince, and Ophelia is simply not in his league. Hamlet is still young, free of responsibilities, free to be in love with her, but warns, you must fear. He is a royal, and as such, his will is not his own.
He may not, as unvalued persons do, carve for himself, for on his choice depends the safety and health of this whole state. And therefore must his choice be circumscribed unto the voice and yielding of that body whereof he is the head.
Hamlet is simply not free to make choices as a commoner might. He has to put the needs of his country first, because one day he may be king.
Then if he says he loves you, it fits your wisdom so far to believe it, as he in his particular act and place may give his saying deed, which is no further than the main voice of Denmark goes withal. Then weigh what loss your honour may sustain if with too credent ear you list his songs, or lose your heart or your chaste treasure open to his unmastered importunity.
You need to protect yourself, sister. You will be ruined if you sleep with him, because whether he loves you or not, he will not be able to marry you.
Fear it, Ophelia, fear it, my dear sister. And keep you in the rear of your affection, out of the shot and danger of desire. The chariest maid is prodigal enough if she unmasked her beauty to the moon. Virtue itself scapes not calumnious strokes.
Dirt sticks. No matter how careful you are, people will talk and your reputation will be destroyed. Now, by the way, the moon here represents female sexuality. Laertes says he wants to protect Ophelia's reputation, but you have to wonder to what extent he wishes to shield his own family name too. After all, he is the pompous son of a pompous courtier. He advises her to be cold and logical, to repress her feelings, to forgo passion and love.
The canker galls the infants of the spring too oft before their buttons be disclosed, and in the morn and liquid dew of youth, contagious blastments are most imminent. Be wary, then. Best safety lies in fear. Youth to itself rebels, though none else near.
Celibacy is best, says Laertes, as even the most beautiful and pure of roses will suffer if its bud opens too early. He tells her to be wary and afraid, to always assume the worst. You will be nothing short of destroyed if you have sex before marriage. Well, his attitude tells us quite a lot about the state of Denmark and court society. I should also highlight Laertes' reference to violets and roses here, because from this point on, Ophelia is often associated with flowers.
I shall the effect of this good lesson keep as watchman to my heart. But, good my brother, do not, as some ungracious pastors do, show me the steep and thorny way to heaven, whilst like a puffed and reckless libertine himself, the primrose path of dalliance treads, and wrecks not his own reed.
In agreeing to take his advice on board, she adds a warning of her own, and in doing so, stands up for herself a little. Don't preach a pious sermon to me, and live a sinful life yourself.
Oh, fear me not. I stay too long.
At the time the play was both written and set, repression and fear was used to keep women in their place, especially within the royal court. Women's role in society was very limited, and they were rarely seen as little more than an extension of their father or their husband. Consequently, if a woman's honour was in question, by extension, so too was the honour of her family. Polonius enters.
But here my father comes. A double blessing is a double grace. Occasion smiles upon a second leave.
Yet here, Laertes. Aboard, aboard for shame. The wind sits in the shoulder of your sail, and you are stayed for. There, my blessing with thee. And these few precepts, in thy memory look thou character.
You need to get going, boy. The weather is perfect for the trip and everyone's waiting for you. And like father, like son, Polonius simply cannot hold back from giving advice.
Give thy thoughts no tongue, nor any unproportioned thought his act. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Those friends thou hast and their adoption tried, grapple them unto thy soul with hoops of steel. But do not dull thy palm with entertainment of each new-hatched unfledged courage. Beware of entrance to a quarrel. But being in, bear it that the opposed may beware of thee. Give every man thy ear, but few thy voice. Take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. Costly thy habit, as thy purse can buy, but not expressed in fancy. Rich, not gaudy, for the apparel oft proclaims the man. And they in France of the best rank and station are of a most select and generous chief in that. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. For loan oft loses both itself and friend, and borrowing dulls the edge of husbandry. This above all, to thine own self be true. And it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Farewell. My blessing season this in thee.
Much of Polonius's advice is sound. Be nice, make friends, and try to keep the ones you have. Don't be rude, don't fight, don't talk too much, but try to listen. Dress well, but avoid being flashy. Don't borrow money, etc., etc. Now, Ophelia has just warned Laertes against hypocrisy, and the irony here is that Polonius could take some of his own advice too, as he's a terrible sneak, spy, and gossip. Now, to thine own self be true is a very interesting line, because in many ways it cuts to the heart of the play. Men must determine their own moral compass and stick to it. This is Hamlet's dilemma, as he wrestles with his desire to be true to what he believes in, but at the same time wishes to make his father proud, to carry out the ghost's call for revenge.
Most humbly do I take my leave, my lord.
The time invests you. Go. Your servants tend.
Farewell, Ophelia, and remember well what I have said to you.
'Tis in my memory locked, and you yourself shall keep the key of it.
Farewell.
What is it, Ophelia, he has said to you?
So please you, something touching the Lord Hamlet.
Marry, well bethought. 'Tis told me he hath very oft of late given private time to you. And you yourself have of your audience been most free and bounteous. If it be so, as so 'tis put on me, and that in way of caution, I must tell you do not understand yourself so clearly, as it behoves my daughter and your honour. What is between you? Give me up the truth.
Polonius speaks like an ultra-polite courtier. His advice is wrapped up in florid language, but essentially he says the same as Laertes. Ophelia sees too much of Hamlet, and her honour is under threat.
He hath, my lord, of late, made many tenders of his affection to me.
Affection? Pooh! You speak like a green girl, unsifted in such perilous circumstance. Do you believe his tenders, as you call them?
I do not know, my lord, what I should think.
Marry, I will teach you.
I do not know what I should think. Now, this line gives us some insight into Ophelia, because she does know what she thinks, but will not assert herself and express her true feelings. Even though she loves Hamlet, she allows her father and brother to manipulate her into a position of weakness.
Think yourself a baby, that you have obtained these tenders for true pay, which are not sterling. Tender yourself more dearly. Or, not to crack the wind of the poor phrase, running it thus, you'll tender me a fool.
Polonius actually admits here that he's looking out for himself. He fears that Ophelia has mistakenly developed a childlike crush on Hamlet that could make a fool of him at court. His only concern is for his good name. His daughter's emotions don't seem to come into it.
My lord, he hath importuned me with love in honourable fashion.
Fashion you may call it. Go to, go to.
And hath given countenance to his speech, my lord, with almost all the holy vows of heaven.
Aye, springs to catch woodcocks.
This is deeply insulting, not only to poor Ophelia, but to Hamlet as well. Polonius says that young men, himself included back in the day, will say anything to get a girl into bed. The woodcock, which is a bird, represents Ophelia's virginity, and Polonius says that Hamlet's words of love are a trap to take it.
I do know when the blood burns how prodigal the soul lends the tongue vows. These blazes, daughter, giving more light than heat, extincting both, even in their promise as it is a-making, you must not take for fire. From this time, be something scanter of your maiden presence. Set your entreatments at a higher rate than a command to parley. For Lord Hamlet, believe so much in him that he is young, and with a larger tether may he walk than may be given to you. In few, Ophelia, do not believe his vows, for they are brokers, not of that dye which their investments show, but mere imploritors of unholy suits, breathing like sanctified and pious bonds the better to beguile. This is for all. I would not, in plain terms, from this time forth, have you so slander any moment leisure as to give words or talk with the Lord Hamlet. Now look to it, I charge you. Come your ways.
I shall obey, my lord.
So Ophelia agrees to stop seeing Hamlet, and both father and daughter leave as the scene draws to a close. Poor Ophelia! She could barely get a word in edgeways. The language and imagery of containment, traps, bonds and tethers clearly show us a young woman who is dominated by the men in her life. She is slightly more open with her brother, but meekly bends to her father's will. Act 1, Scene 4. We're on the battlements of Elsinore Castle. Hamlet enters with Horatio and Marcellus, hoping for another appearance from the ghost.
The air bites shrewdly. It is very cold.
It is a nipping and an eager air.
What hour now?
I think it lacks of 12.
Now it is struck.
Another anachronism from Shakespeare here, as striking clocks were yet to be invented. Anyhow, Marcellus says that midnight has struck, and so the ghost should appear any time now.
Indeed, I heard it not. It then draws near the season wherein the spirit held his wont to walk. What does this mean, my lord?
The king doth wake tonight and takes his rouse, keeps wassail, and the swaggering upspring reels. And as he drains his draughts of Rhenish down, the kettle drum and trumpet thus bray out the triumph of his pledge.
Hamlet is quite contemptuous of the fact that Claudius is partying somewhere in the castle. Shakespeare juxtaposes the seriousness of Hamlet and his quest and the frivolity of Claudius and his raucous revelry. He masterfully places them side by side in order to be compared and contrasted.
Is it a custom?
Marry, is't. But to my mind, though I am native here, and to the manner born, it is a custom, more honoured in the breach than the observance. This heavy-headed revel, east and west, makes us traduced and taxed of other nations. They clep us drunkards, and with swinish phrase soil our addition. And indeed, it takes from our achievements, though performed at height, the pith and marrow of our attribute.
Here, for the first time, Hamlet actually speaks like a prince. He complains that his country's reputation is being soiled, that the world will perceive all Danes as drunks because of Claudius's partying.
So oft it chances in particular men that for some vicious mole of nature in them, as in their birth, wherein they are not guilty, since nature cannot choose his origin, by their o'ergrowth of some complexion, oft breaking down the pales and thoughts of reason, or by some habit, that too much o'erleavens the form of plausive manners, that these men, carrying, I say, the stamp of one defect, being nature's livery or fortune's star, his virtues else be they as pure as grace, as infinite as man may undergo, shall, in the general censure, take corruption from that particular fault. The dram of evil doth all the noble substance often doubt to his own scandal.
Now this is interesting. It seems that Hamlet believes we are who we are, that we cannot change our nature. A single defect or flaw can destroy even the purest of men, because his own destiny or nature will drive him to his downfall. As he muses over this thought, the ghost appears.
Look, my lord, it comes.
Angels and ministers of grace, defend us. Be thou a spirit of health, or goblin damned. Bring with thee airs from heaven, or blasts from hell. Be thy intents wicked or charitable, thou comest in such a questionable shape that I will speak to thee. I'll call thee Hamlet, King, Father, Royal Dane. Oh, answer me. Let me not burst in ignorance. But tell why thy canonized bones, hearsed in death, have burst their cerements. Why the sepulchre wherein we saw thee quietly inured hath oped his ponderous and marble jaws to cast thee up again. What may this mean, that thou, dead corpse, again in complete steel, revisit'st thus the glimpses of the moon, making night hideous, and we, fools of nature, so horridly to shake our disposition with thoughts beyond the riches of our souls? Say, why is this? Wherefore? What should we do?
Hamlet immediately recognizes the ghost to be his father. But I saw you buried. Why have you come back? What do you want? The ghost does not answer, but beckons Hamlet to go with him.
It beckons you to go away with it, as if it some impartment did desire to you alone.
Look with what courteous action it waves you to a more removed ground, but do not go with it.
No, by no means.
It will not speak, then I will follow it.
Do not, my lord.
Why? What should be the fear? I do not set my life at a pin's fee, and for my soul, what can it do to that, being a thing immortal as itself? It waves me forth again. I'll follow it.
What if it tempts you toward the flood, my lord, or to the dreadful summit of the cliff that beetles o'er his base into the sea, and there assume some other horrible form which might deprive your sovereignty of reason and draw you into madness? Think of it! The very place puts toys of desperation without more motive into every brain that looks so many fathoms to the sea and hears its roar beneath.
It waves me still.
Hamlet is determined to follow the ghost. He sees nothing to fear, but Horatio argues that it could drive him mad or even lead him over a cliff.
Go on, I'll follow thee.
You shall not go, my lord.
Hold off your hands.
Be ruled, you shall not go.
My fate cries out and makes each petty artery in this body as hardy as the Nemean lion's nerve.
Earlier Hamlet said he was no Hercules, yet now believes he has the courage and strength of the Nemean lion. Although Hercules fought and killed this mythical beast, it was fantastically strong, and the reference shows us that the ghost's appearance has given Hamlet a greater strength and purpose than before, even if he's not quite up to Herculean standards.
Still am I called. Unhand me, gentlemen! By heaven, I'll make a ghost of him that lets me. I say away! Go on. I'll follow thee.
The ghost moves off, and Hamlet follows, leaving Horatio and Marcellus alone.
He waxes desperate with imagination.
Let's follow. 'Tis not fit thus to obey him.
Have after. To what issue will this come?
Something is rotten in the state of Denmark.
The idea that Denmark is rotting echoes Hamlet's earlier speech about flaws, because the rot is deeply rooted. Internal, not external.
Heaven will direct it.
Nay, let's follow him.
The scene comes to an end as Horatio and Marcellus leave to follow Hamlet's trail. Act 1, Scene 5. It's a few minutes later. The ghost has led Hamlet to a remote part of the castle where they can speak in private.
Whither wilt thou lead me? Speak! I'll go no further.
Mark me!
I will.
My hour is almost come, when I to sulphurous and tormenting flames must render up myself.
Alas, poor ghost.
Pity me not, but lend thy serious hearing to what I shall unfold.
Speak, I am bound to hear.
So art thou to revenge when thou shalt hear.
What?
I am my father's spirit.
So the ghost is definitely Hamlet's father. He's returned to seek revenge, which he believes Hamlet will feel bound or obligated to carry out once he knows the full story.
Doomed for a certain term to walk the night, and for the day confined to fast in fires, till the foul crimes done in my days of nature are burnt and purged away.
The ghost describes purgatory, a place or state in which dead souls exist as punishment for their sins in life.
But that I am forbid to tell the secrets of my prison house, I could a tale unfold whose lightest word would harrow up thy soul, freeze thy young blood, make thy two eyes like stars start from their spheres, thy knotted and combined locks to part, and each particular hair to stand on end like quills upon the fretful porpentine. But this eternal blazon must not be to ears of flesh and blood.
I cannot tell a mortal the details of what happens in purgatory.
List, list, oh list. If thou didst ever thy dear father love...
Oh, God!
Revenge is foul and most unnatural murder.
And there we have it. Old Hamlet did not die of natural causes, but was murdered.
Murder?
Murder most foul, as in the best it is. For this most foul, strange, and unnatural.
Haste me to know it, that I, with wings as swift as meditation or the thoughts of love, may sweep to my revenge.
I find thee apt, and duller shouldst thou be than the fat weed that roots itself in ease on Lethe wharf, wouldst thou not stir in this. Now, Hamlet, here. "'Tis given out that sleeping in my orchard a serpent stung me. "'So the whole ear of Denmark is by a forged process of my death rankly abused. "'But know, thou noble youth, the serpent that did sting thy father's life "'now wears his crown!'
"'Oh, my prophetic soul, my uncle!'
"'Ay, that incestuous, that adulterate beast!' With witchcraft of his wit, with traitorous gifts. Oh, wicked wit and gifts that have the power so to seduce. One to his shameful lust, the will of my most seeming virtuous queen.
What really hurts is the fact that Gertrude has fallen for his brother's charms, as if he had some magical power over her. Now it takes two to tango, but old Hamlet sees Gertrude as the innocent lamb, and Claudius as the adulterous beast. He wants Hamlet to see it that way too, to focus his revenge on his uncle.
Oh, Hamlet, what a falling off was there. From me, whose love was of that dignity that it went hand in hand, even with the vow I made to her in marriage, and to decline upon a wretch whose natural gifts were poor to those of mine. But virtue, as it never will be moved, though lewdness caught it in a shape of heaven, so lust, though to a radiant angel linked, will sate itself in a celestial bed and prey on garbage.
Again, old Hamlet defends his wife. Yes, she is a radiant angel, but she is also a woman with sexual needs, and it is this lust that forced her into his filthy brother's bed. The ghost could go on, but realizes that dawn is close, and he has more to tell Hamlet before he has to leave.
But soft, methinks I scent the morning air. Brief, let me be. Sleeping within my orchard, my custom always of the afternoon, upon my secure hour, thy uncle stole with juice of cursed hebanon in a vial, and in the porches of mine ears did pour the leprous distillment, whose effect holds such an enmity with blood of man that swift as quicksilver it courses through the natural gates and alleys of the body.
And with sudden vigour it doth toss it and curd like eager droppings into milk, the thin and wholesome blood. So did it mine, and the most instant tetter barked about most lazar-like with vile and loathsome crust all my smooth body.
So, while old Hamlet took a nap in the garden, Claudius poisoned him by pouring Hebenon juice into his ear. His death was quick but nasty, as the whole of his body curdled and scabbed like that of a lazar or leper.
Thus was I sleeping by a brother's hand of life, of crown, of queen at once dispatched, cut off even in the blossoms of my sin. Unhouseled, disappointed, unannealed, no reckoning made, but sent to my account with all my imperfections on my head. Oh, horrible!
In poisoning him, Claudius robbed his brother of the opportunity to confess his sins and receive last rites, which is why he now suffers in purgatory.
Oh, horrible! Most horrible! If thou hast nature in thee, bear it not. Let not the royal bed of Denmark be a couch for luxury and damned incest. But howsomever thou pursuest this act, taint not thy mind, nor let thy soul contrive against thy mother aught. Leave her to heaven, and to those thorns that in her bosom lodge to prick and sting her. Fare thee well at once. The glowworm shows the matin to be near, and gains to pale his ineffectual fire.
Revenge me against Claudius, but leave your mother out of it. God will be her judge, and perhaps her own feelings of guilt, when she knows the truth. As dawn approaches, the ghost of old Hamlet leaves.
Adieu! 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 Remember me!
Oh, you host of heaven! Oh, earth! What else?
And shall I couple hell? Oh, fie, hold my heart, and you, my sinews, grow not instant old, but bear me stiffly up. Remember thee. Aye, thou poor ghost, whilst memory holds a seat in this distracted globe. Remember thee, yea, from the table of my memory I'll wipe away all trivial fond records, all sores of books, all forms, all precious past, that youth and observation copied there, and thy commandment all alone shall live within the book and volume of my brain, unmixed with baser matter. Yes, by heaven!
Hamlet says he will wipe all other thoughts and memories from his mind, so that his father's commandment for revenge will be his sole intent.
Oh, most pernicious woman! Oh, villain, villain, smiling, damned villain!
And so, despite his father's wishes, Hamlet does not consider his mother to be innocent. Far from it.
My tables, meet it is I set it down, that one may smile and smile and be a villain. At least I'm sure it may be so in Denmark.
Hamlet pulls out his notebook to set it down. With this simple act, Shakespeare brilliantly shows us that Hamlet prefers to write down his thoughts than to act upon them. He is an academic, a man of thought, reason and argument, not a man of physical action. As a prince and as a revenger, this is his fatal flaw.
So, uncle, there you are. Now, to my word, it is adieu, adieu, remember me, I have sworn.
We know from records kept at the time that William Shakespeare first played old Hamlet's ghost on stage to Richard Burbage's Hamlet. Because the play centres on father and son relationships, loyalties and responsibilities, there is a real poignancy in having Shakespeare himself speak to Hamlet, especially when you bear in mind the deaths of his own dear son, Hamlet, a few years earlier, and his father in 1601. Any analysis of the play must consider Shakespeare's own family situation. Young Hamlet, for example, would have lived in Stratford, and so it's doubtful that Shakespeare, living and working in London, would have often seen him. And so when the ghost says, "If thou didst ever thy dear father love," we can't help but wonder if Shakespeare is speaking to his own Hamlet. As Hamlet swears to remember, Horatio and Marcellus arrive.
My lord! My lord!
Lord Hamlet!
Heaven secure him.
So be it.
Hello, my lord!
Hello, boy, come, bird, come!
Hello is the call a falconer makes to his bird. Now, this may seem an odd time for Hamlet to start making jokes, but from this point on, his speech patterns are not as clear and precise as they were as he begins to crack under the pressure.
How is
my noble lord?
What news, my lord?
Oh, wonderful!
Could my lord tell it?
No, you will reveal it.
Hamlet's first instincts here are to be secretive and mistrusting. This poses the question of how does he view the royal court? He doesn't seem to trust the lead courtiers or see it as any sort of forum for justice. Of course, in Shakespeare's day, Elizabeth's court was a dangerous place to be. Courtiers would be favourites one day and dead the next, like Essex, who was executed for treason.
Not I, my lord, by heaven.
Nor I, my lord.
How say you, then, would heart of man once think it? But you'll be secret?
Aye, by heaven.
There's never a villain dwelling in all Denmark, but he's an arrant knave.
There needs no ghost, my lord, come from the grave to tell us this.
Why, right. You are in the right. And so, without more circumstance at all, I hold it fit that we shake hands and part. You, as your business and desire shall point you, for every man hath business and desire, such as it is. And for my own poor part, I will go pray.
These are but wild and whirling words, my lord.
Hamlet is keen to shake hands and leave, but Horatio wants him to stop his wild and whirling talk and tell them what happened.
I am sorry they offend you heartily. Yes, faith, heartily.
There's no offence, my lord.
Yes, by Saint Patrick, but there is, Horatio, and much offence too. Touching this vision here, it is an honest ghost. That, let me tell you. For your desire to know what is between us, or master it as you may. And now, good friends, as you are friends, scholars and soldiers, give me one poor request.
What is, my lord? We will.
Never make known what you have seen tonight.
As my friends, please understand and accept that I don't wish to talk about what happened tonight, and promise me that you won't say a word about it.
My lord, we will not.
We will not.
Nay, but swear it.
In faith, my lord, not I.
Nor I, my lord, in faith.
Upon my sword.
We have sworn, my lord, already.
His sword held upright would look like a crucifix, and so Hamlet asks them to swear on the cross. His insistence here shows that his secrecy and mistrust is growing into paranoia.
Indeed, upon my sword, indeed.
Swear!
Horatio and Marcellus are shocked as the ghost's voice rises from below, echoing Hamlet's request.
Ha, boy, sayst thou so? Art thou there, Trupany? Come on, you hear this fellow in the cellarage? Consent to swear.
Propose the oath, my lord.
Never to speak of this that you have seen. Swear by my sword.
Swear.
We do. We do.
Ic et ubique, then we'll shift our ground. Come hither, gentlemen, and lay your hands again upon my sword. Swear by my sword, never to speak of this that you have heard.
Hamlet decides that's not enough, and they move to another place to swear on the sword yet again.
Swear by his sword.
We do.
Well said, old mole. Canst work in the earth so fast? A worthy pioneer.
Hamlet congratulates the ghost on how quickly he moves through the earth to follow them. Here, Shakespeare gives a bit of a nod to the magic of theatre, as of course the actor is moving under the wooden stage and not the hard ground beneath the castle.
Once more remove, good friends.
Oh, day and night, but this is wondrous strange.
And therefore, as a stranger, give it welcome. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Now, this is interesting because the friends studied philosophy together at Wittenberg. And so Hamlet must believe that his experience with the ghost has shown him something new. That he and Horatio no longer have the same outlook on life.
But come, Here, as before, never so help you mercy. How strange or odd some air I bear myself. As I perchance hereafter shall think meet to put an antic disposition on, that you at such time seeing me never shall with arms encumbered thus, or this head shake, or by pronouncing of some doubtful phrase, as, well, we know, or we could, and if we would, or if we list to speak, or there be, and if they might, or such ambiguous giving out to note, that you know aught of me. This do swear, so grace and mercy at your most need help you.
Earlier, Horatio said that speaking with the ghost alone could lead to madness, and now Hamlet says that he plans to pretend to be mad, to put on an antic disposition, and that Horatio and Marcellus must go along with it. And, of course, Hamlet asks them yet again to swear, this time that they will not betray his pretense of madness.
Swear!
We do.
Rest. Rest, perturbed spirit. So, gentlemen, with all my love I do commend me to you, and what so poor a man as Hamlet is may do to express his love and friending to you, God willing, shall not lack. Let us go in together. And still, your fingers on your lips, I pray.
Hamlet tells the ghost to rest. And as Horatio and Marcellus move to leave, he reminds them to keep his secret and makes something of a laboured and excessive show of his friendship.
The time is out of joint. Oh, cursed spite that ever I was born to set it right. Nay, come, let's go together.
Act One closes with these final lines from Hamlet. Earlier, he was keen to right the wrongs done to his father. But now he curses the responsibility of it because he knows he's not the right man for the job, that it's simply not in his nature to be an avenger. And with that, the three men leave. Scene 1. About 2 months have passed since the last scene, during which time Laertes has been in Paris, and Hamlet has been feigning madness in the court, just as he said he would. So Act 2 opens not at the castle, but in a room in Polonius's house. Polonius enters with his servant, Rinaldo, who he is secretly sending to France to check up on his son and to give him money and letters.
Give him this money and these notes, Rinaldo.
I will, my lord.
You shall do marvellous wisely, good Rinaldo, before you visit him to make inquire of his behaviour.
My lord, I did intend it.
Marry, well said. Very well said. Look you, sir. Inquire me first what danskers are in Paris, and how and who, what means and where they keep, what company at what expense? And finding by this encompassment and drift of question that they do know, my son, come you more nearer than your particular demands will touch it. Take you, as 'twere, some distant knowledge of him, as thus. I know his father, and his friends, and in part him. Do you mark this, Rinaldo?
Danskers are Danes, and Polonius wants Rinaldo to find fellow Danes in Paris who know Laertes.
Aye, very well, my lord.
And in part him, but, you may say, not well. If it be he, I mean, he's very wild, addicted so-and-so. And there put on him what forger as you please. Marry, none so rank as may dishonour him. Take heed of that. But, sir, such wanton, wild, and usual slips as are companions noted and most known to youth and liberty.
As gaming, my lord?
Aye, or drinking, fencing, swearing, quarrelling, drabbing, you may go so far.
Polonius instructs Rinaldo to spread rumours against his own son, to go so far as to say that he gambles, drinks, fights, swears and visits prostitutes. That's what drabbing means. He leaves it up to Rinaldo to tell whatever lies he wants, which makes Rinaldo very uncomfortable.
My lord, that would dishonour him.
Faith, no. As you may season it in the charge. You must not put another scandal on him. That he is open to incontinency, that's not my meaning. But breathe his faults so quaintly that they may seem the taints of liberty, the flash and outbreak of a fiery mind, a savageness in unreclaimed blood of general sort.
Rinaldo is worried for Laertes' honour, but Polonius says the vice as he describes won't cause a scandal. They're nothing more than the taints of liberty, what you would expect from a young man with too much freedom. Polonius mentioned earlier that he'd been a bit of a hellraiser in his day, and it seems he expects no less from Laertes. In fact, he'd be disappointed if his son isn't running around boozing and whoring.
But my good lord...
Wherefore should you do this?
Aye, my lord, I would know that.
Marry, sir, here's my drift, and I believe it is a fetch of warrant. You laying these slight sullies on my son, as 'twere a little thing soiled in the working, mark you, your party in converse, him you would sound having ever seen in the predominate crimes the youth you breathe of guilty, be assured he closes with you in this consequence. Good sir, or so, or friend, or gentleman, according to the phrase or the addition of man and country.
Very good, my lord.
And then, sir, does he this. He does. Oh, what was I about to say? By the mass, I was about to say something. Where did I leave?
At closes in the consequence.
At closes in the consequence, I marry. He closes thus. I know the gentleman. I saw him yesterday, or the other day.